This is Tuesday morning, June 18th, and my name is Martin Dowling. We're in Jack Pelisek's office downtown Milwaukee, and we want to talk about the merger of University of Wisconsin and the state college system. I guess the best place to begin is if we could just review how you became associated with the university first, what the background on your appointment was to the Board of Regents, and how you were involved with the university before that.
I went there. I mean, my involvement with the university was that I had 2 degrees from the University of Wisconsin. The background of my appointment was simply that coming back from Washington one day on an airplane, when we touched down in Milwaukee, the stewardess came to the front door and asked if there was a Mr. Pelisek on board, and I said yes, and she said, some reporters want to see you, and I was advised at that point by a reporter from the Journal and the Sentinel that I'd been appointed a regent to the University of Wisconsin.
By Governor Knowles?
By Governor Warren P. Knowles.
Mm-hmm.
Knowles and I had never discussed it beforehand.
There was no other advanced warning there?
No, not really. Early on, several years before that, some people had suggested that I might be an appropriate appointee, but there was no interview process or discussion at the time of my actual appointment.
What year was that?
Boy, 1969, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So that was, were you working in Madison at the time?
No, I was here. Yeah. No, I've been practicing law here since 1958.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't we talk about the merger? I want to get your impressions, if you were at the time or now had any strong opinions in the 69 and 70 about the condition of higher education in Wisconsin.
Did I have strong opinions in 1969 and 1970? I think I did.
Yeah.
I think they were quoted rather extensively in the newspaper at the time. And in fact, I just saw a 10-year anniversary, an anniversary, not 10 years, it's been longer than that, an anniversary issue of the State Journal on the campus unrest in those,
mm-hmm.
In those days, and the same quote was used in that that had been used at the time. I was very concerned about the state of the university at the in 1969 and early 1970. The administration of the institution had allowed the institution to go to hell, frankly. Operation of the institution was on the verge of chaos, and those were difficult times, but the administration was, and in particular the president of the institution was shirking his responsibilities.
Which responsibilities?
His responsibilities to keep a campus open for educational purposes rather than to allow it to be overtaken by both faculty and students for purely political purposes, which is exactly what was happening.
And did you see any way around that?
I think the way around it was stronger leadership of the campus. It certainly wasn't merger, and that didn't lead to merger.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there any impressions with regard to, the balance between the Madison campus and the other campuses in the state?
No, not particularly. That was a, you were operating with a very, very ineffective higher education council, or the coordinating, it's been so long I don't even remember the name, but I guess it was the Coordinating Council for Higher Education, of which I was a member, a totally useless organization, totally ineffective, staffed by people from the institutions, from the three sets of institutions, the university, the state university, and the Voc Tech, each had their own, it appeared to me at least, very parochial views of their institutions. Not a hell of a lot of care for any statewide plan, much more concern for the well-being of their own institutions. And then you had some public members that didn't know a damn thing about education. I think most of them were, several of them at least, were private education oriented and had a, had some pretty deep animosity toward public higher education.
Do you have, are you thinking of particular people? Do you call names?
Oh, I don't think it's appropriate to name names at this point.
Okay.
I mean, even though this is history, this is supposed to be for history, I guess I'd just as soon not name names. But the records of those sessions will rather clearly indicate the people that were involved.
Well, yeah, CCHE is beat up upon by most anyone who will recall education in the 60s. Was there...
Well, CCHE was there to be a log rolling function. I mean, that's the way it was created. That was the way it was structured.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no other result that could follow. I don't criticize the people or the staff or anything else. It was predestined just by the way the damn thing was structured. The legislature was groping around for some way to try to resolve the competitiveness, and rather than make the tough decisions, they just dumped it off to somebody else.
What did you make of the arguments that were voiced in 70 and 71 that there was an inequality between the Madison campus and the other campuses around the state, that, that students at those campuses were short-shrifted and faculties were underpaid, and that, that that it should be one system?
I've never heard faculty say they were overpaid in now 20 years of observing higher education.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my response to that is now and was then. So what? I mean, you have to have a system where one or two institutions, if you're going to have multiple institutions, one or two institutions are going to be preeminent. I mean, not every private institution can be Harvard. Ripon has to be Ripon, and Beloit has to be Beloit, and struggle to survive. And they survive by providing some kind of quality that people will accept. The state institutions, the state system, basically then and in some instances now, are high schools with ashtrays.
Yeah.
And didn't provide a very good product. I'm not so sure some of them provide a very good product now, despite all the hype they put out.
So you were opposed to the merger?
No, not necessarily. I thought the merger could provide some efficiencies. In fact, when the board considered the merger the first time around, and I also think that merger was just a smokescreen, so Pat Lucey could concentrate on redistribution of shared tax revenue in the state of Wisconsin. That was the key issue for that period of time. Merger was an afterthought, and it dawned on him that, or somebody advising him that merger could raise a hell of a lot of smoke and would generate a lot of conversation and interest, and you could slip tax distribution through without anybody getting terribly excited about it.
Is that what happened in 71?
Sure, it happened in 71. There were substantial changes in the shared revenue formulas that nobody remembers.
Because everyone was worried about
merger. Everybody was all concentrating on the fluff and hoopla of merger.
Mm-hmm. It's not, even though you might think that merger was a good idea and could have saved some money, it wasn't something whose time had come. It was sort of a...
No, I don't think it was something whose time has come. It was it started as a blip in a speech that Pat gave during the campaign, and a couple people grabbed to it. And when you're running for governor, and you've lost once or twice before, you grab for anything you can grab. And he saw a little interest in that, and he grabbed for it. And he got a little support from people like Dreyfus.
Could you explain a little more about the tax redistribution? I've read that it was, you know, that merger was just noise to detract from that, but I haven't heard anybody say, I mean, I haven't heard that from anyone on the campus or that I've been.
Oh, I don't think the people on the campus would even understand that. I don't. Yeah. The people on the campus are so myopic that they don't even know how the money gets in their budgets, let alone how taxes are distributed to the municipalities around the state. It was a substantial modification of the distribution formula. Mm-hmm. People, if you went out and interviewed with your little machine here people on the street and asked them what happens to their state income tax, I would venture that not one in ten would tell you that a substantial portion of it comes back to the very municipality that we're walking down the street of. That a goodly part of the revenues that the state collects come back to the municipalities in the form of shared revenues. And the basis for the formula was that provide that return of revenue from the state to the municipality were radically changed in that legislative session. It was one of Pat Lucey's pet projects. That's something he really wanted to accomplish. I don't think he gave a damn whether merger was accomplished or not. Mm-hmm. He will now probably tell you that it was uppermost in his mind, but I think it was an afterthought. You can tell that from the way it was broached. He didn't have a speech on it. He didn't give a speech on this marvelous concept. It was an afterthought it was one little paragraph in a speech that he gave. It wasn't even the basic thrust of his white paper on higher education. I mean, his thrust on higher education was the same as everybody else's at that point in time. The campus was out of control, and you had to get some people in there that could run it. Merger wasn't his basic thrust.
Well, after he announced that he was going to attempt to merge almost immediately after he was elected, and what, were you active, shall I say, politically in 1971 to affect the course of that bill as it went through the legislature?
I was, I knew a few people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was fairly well known in legislative circles, but my own attitude really, and I didn't lobby on that bill one way or the other. I mean, I didn't work mm-hmm. the legislature one way or the other. People, legislators that would call me, I would talk to, and some did, but I didn't spend any time in the halls of the legislature. In part, that was a role that Weaver felt was best handled by Fish, mm-hmm. who was purported to be very effective in that sort of thing. And in fact, everybody thought that the bill had been defeated. Mm-hmm. As I said, Odie just didn't count very well, that's all. And he didn't realize that sometimes you get people's votes for other reasons than the merits of the particular legislation, although he knew that happened all the time. He just didn't anticipate that, or he didn't count it very well. The board was opposed to merger and was on record in opposition to merger. And I was the only one that voted against that. I was the only one that said we ought to look at it. Mm-hmm. And when we got to the combined boards, I mean, I was there with John Levine when the old State University Board and the combined board met to discuss all this. I mean, it was some unholy alliances of Pelosek and Levine and Mary Williams and McNamara, saying we ought to look at this. I certainly wasn't strongly supporting the concept at that point as Levine and McNamara over on the other side, because they were early Democratic appointees, filling some vacancies, I think. And Mary Williams was a close friend of Dreyfus, and Dreyfus was supporting this up at Stevens Point. But I was the only one on the UW board that supported it, and I didn't want to be in a position of lobbying the legislature to support it. when the board was opposed to it. And I wasn't really strongly supporting it. I was just taking the position we ought to look at it. It's something we ought to consider because CCHE was so ineffective.
Yeah. Your position was that, I mean, it might be worthwhile and not that, hey, this thing is going to pass anyway and we should look at it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Both.
No, not that, hey, this thing is going to pass anyway, we ought to look at it. I mean, I think that the legislative lineup was such that, it was a very close call in the Senate, and it was a one-vote shift, and a judgeship bought merger. I mean, it was that simple. When push came to shove, some guy got bought off. All right, now his name returns to me suddenly, too.
I talked to Mr. Lucy a couple of weeks ago, and he said that he didn't think that that merger would have passed if Harrington had still been around.
Oh, that was that's a bunch of crap.
Yeah. He felt that, or he said that replacing Harrington with Weaver was a loss of leadership for the Madison campus.
Well, that's because Fred Harvey Harrington was a bosom buddy of Pat Lucy's. A wild-eyed, knee-jerk liberal, and I suppose I shouldn't say that because we've hired Pat Lucy's daughter in our Madison office. But Pat Lucy was buddy-buddy with that liberal element of the university that Harrington led. The public be damned. I'm Fred Harvey Harrington, and I run this institution the way I'm going to run it. And Pat was part of that. John Weaver was a different kind of guy. And John Weaver and Pat Lucy never liked each other from the moment they set eyes on each other. And Pat couldn't possibly like John Weaver. I mean, he was committed in advance before he ever met John Weaver not to like him. Because he ordered us not to hire anybody. Until the election was over.
You took part in the appointment of...
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure, he ordered us not to hire anybody. And the board said, stuff it. And went ahead and hired somebody. Well, what choice did he have but to dislike John Weaver? I mean, there was no alternative for him.
So how did your position differ from Weaver's and people in the administration?
Oh, I think John was adamantly opposed. I mean, John's position was that he came back to run the University of Wisconsin, and he didn't want to run all these other rinky-dink institutions. And, you know, John was created out of Madison. I mean, he was a child of Madison. And he looked with great disdain at places like Platteville. I mean, and even he would even do just what I just did, put disdain in his voice the way he described the institution or said the name of the institution. But the places like Superior and River Falls and Platteville and the like, he looked upon with great disdain, as did most of the Madison campus.
Mm-hmm.
And with some merit. I mean, some of those institutions weren't very good. But John was totally opposed to merger. I was sort of ambivalent. It didn't bother me too much at all. But John and I were very close. Weaver and I were very close friends. We were close personal friends. I mean, I used to stay there at the house during regent meetings and things like that. So John and Roberta and I were close friends. And I didn't feel at that point in time that it was certainly my position to be a vocal advocate of merger. But I didn't see inherent in it great evils.
Did the relationship between Lucy and Weaver have to be as bad as it was? I mean,
no.
No,
it was just happened to be two pretty hard-nosed guys.
Yeah.
John was not terribly hard-nosed in the sense of being a gruff, rough and tumble type guy. I mean, he was a guy that had to be loved and cuddled all the time. And but he just, when he didn't like somebody, he made everybody know it. Wasn't letting everybody know it, he made everybody know it. I mean, he went out of his way to let people know that he didn't like X, and X turned out to be Pat Lucy. and in a university town or a university state capital town like Madison, you know, that does it doesn't take more than 15 yeah. minutes for that to get back to somebody who's close to the governor. And even if John would have said something simple like, Pat and I don't seem to get along, by the time it got back to Lucy, it was Weaver's out there bad-mouthing you. I don't think that relationship had to be as bad as it was, I mean, but it was. They just simply didn't like each other.
Could there have been anything done to stop the merger that wasn't done?
No, I think more effective work in the legislature could have.
Yeah. So the board really left that up to Fitch, is that right?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, you had an interesting board. You had probably the board at that point in time was probably as good people as you've had there for some time. Certainly mm-hmm. since, there hasn't been a board comprised of as good people. Just as people.
Who in particular was good?
Oh, I mean, they were all just good. It was a good, cohesive group. I mean, we could fight like hell on Thursday afternoon and all have dinner together without carrying on the rancor of the mm-hmm. of the afternoon. And it was just a good, friendly group. We all kind of liked each other, and we all respected each other. Unfortunately, that isn't happening today, and it's mm-hmm. one of the university system's current problems. You've got some rather ineffective people. Now, the board was a lot smaller, and as a result, people felt more involved, and that may have enhanced their sense of commitment and the like. But they were all good. They were all good, solid people.
Mm-hmm. You were talking earlier about the WSU board.
The WSU board, unfortunately, was parochial. The system of appointing WSU regents was that you had one from every school, and you had mm-hmm. Mick Neshek represented Whitewater, and Roy Kopp represented Platteville, and Jim Solberg represented Stout. And as a result, you got into huge log rolling operations within the old WSU board itself. That's one of the reasons that they didn't make the tough decisions. The board wasn't going to sit down and say, no, Stout, you can't have this program, because their institution might want a program the following month, and they didn't want to have to go back and say, I couldn't get it. That was one of their, but they were all good people too. That was they were not that board was not bad people, but their role was a parochial role. Each one of them was they were assigned to a campus. There was a diligent effort to find people from the area of a campus in order to make sure that the interests of that campus got protected, and that's the way the guy or lady viewed his role. He had to protect, Mary Williams had to protect Stevens Point. And as a result, there were very few people from Milwaukee or from Racine, Kenosha, or the areas where there were not WSU campuses. I mean, they didn't really represent a cross-section of the population.
Well, did you try and prevent that sort of parochialism on the merge board when you were working in the implementation committee?
On the merged board?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that I don't think that the implementation study committee, and I must admit that was one of my the jabs that I really thought Lucy gave me, because I was a close friend of Weaver's. That was one of the first of the jabs that I got from my good friend Pat. I was somewhat disappointed that I wasn't selected as chairman of that implementation committee.
Solberg was.
Solberg was. And Solberg had been a strong opponent of a merger. I mean, he'd been a strong vocal opponent. Jim's a nice guy. I don't think he was very effective. But he'd been a strong vocal opponent of merger, and I was really kind of disappointed that the governor appointed him as chairman. Mm-hmm. I mean, he put me on, which I thought was nice, but I really thought I at least I had not been a vocal opponent, that it would be appropriate to have been chairman. But I ended up chairing the drafting committee anyway that wrote the statute. So that really was, as it worked out, it wouldn't have made any difference whether I was chairman or not, because I would have played the same role as I did. But no, I don't think the there was some talk in structuring the language of the appointive language of 36 when we were in the implementation study committee. There was some talk about recommending sector regions, dividing the state into zones and making sure that there was a region from every mm-hmm. from every zone. I've never thought that was a very good idea. I don't think it's a very good idea in this community to divide your school board into districts so that you can get plenty of log rolling going. That really didn't get very far in the implementation study committee. In fact, I don't think it got beyond one.
So the WSU people didn't really want.
They didn't push that very hard. And the WSU people, I don't think any of the I don't view the WSU people as powerful forces in the merger implementation committee. I mean, I don't recall. And I've got extensive files on it, and I purposely didn't look at any of my files before this session. I have maintained a little history here that someday we can give over to the archives, I guess. There's some interesting notes and things in there. Some interesting notes floating around on selection of presidents, too. I don't recall the implementation study committee being a we them type battle. There was a lot of we them battles in the initial organization of the merged board after merger was effective and we were suddenly in a position of having to merge ourselves together. There was a lot of we them fighting in that.
That was before you did the work on the committee.
Oh yes, sure. Yeah. As you well know, the step was that suddenly you had a merged system, and the board was merged, and there was no operational statute for another biennium. So you didn't. You had that hiatus period where the board was there and was functioning, but didn't have a statute to really govern its operations. The actual merging law said that 36 institutions will be governed by old 36 and 37 institutions will be governed by the rules of old 37 until we get a combined statute. And we didn't get a combined statute for 2 years. The real we-them battles arose at the time of organization of the merged board.
We were talking about we and them.
The we's and the we's and the them's?
Was that a problem of just putting, personnel? I mean, who was going to sit next to who and who would be on the board?
No, it wasn't a question of who would be on the board. That was done by just taking everybody. I mean, the legislation avoided any such issues. I mean, they needed every vote they could get, so therefore you didn't antagonize a state senator in La Crosse by taking off the guy from La Crosse. I mean, it was easy. You just threw them all on and let attrition take its toll until you got down to the number that was finally established, which was 14 appointees plus 2. Mm-hmm. But we ended up, I don't know, the first picture of the board that's around someplace is 22 or 23, you had 10 of us, 10 of the old UW regents, and 12 or so of them, 11 or 12 of them. So you ended up with 21, 22. You had some overlap because the state superintendent was on both boards. I don't recall if the VOCTEC president was on both boards or not. It may have been. So you just melded everybody together. So it wasn't a question of who was going to stay on. The question was who was going to be the president, mm-hmm. and what was the structure of the central administrative office. What role was McPhee or somebody, and McPhee kind of got tossed aside because of his age. But mm-hmm. what role was McPhee or somebody from the WSU going to play in the central administration mm-hmm. of the merged system? So that's you got the great Leonard Haas battle, right. and you got the battle over the presidency of the board, the vice presidency of the board, and the committee chairs. Then the biggest fights came over the committee chairs, and those were pure ego mm-hmm. trips.
Could you talk about Len Haas? When I interviewed Donald Percy, he left the impression that Len really didn't want the job and he wanted to go back to Eau Claire.
I don't think Len wanted the job. Mm-hmm. I don't think Len wanted the job. Len Haas is one of the finest guys I know. I mean, Len Haas is just a fine, fine gentleman. But he had no desire at that point in his life to muck around with all the internal sniping and the like that he knew was going to be in that office in Van Hise Hall. And he wasn't the guy for that job, and he knew it, and everybody else knew it, except the state university people insisted he be there.
So who were there other battles over, or controversy over appointment between WSU people?
No, that all kind of melded together, but the question was to get somebody up there in the second-in-command position. I mean, if Weaver was going to be the head, and there was some argument of, I don't know, some thought that maybe Weaver shouldn't be the head. What happened to the other one? No, there was some question as to whether Weaver was going to be the head guy. I mean, that didn't last very long, but that issue was raised. There was some suggestion that maybe Weaver shouldn't be solely the head guy, that they ought to share power and all that sort of thing.
Mm. Well, he had threatened earlier in the year, I believe, to quit if merger passed. Maybe that was an idea.
Yeah, I think John did make some rumblings along those lines, but John's a very fine guy too, but John is not a John was not a guy that took and stuck to terribly strong positions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, John vacillated a little bit. Yeah, and that's not to denigrate him or anything. It's in fact, I like John a lot. But John was just not a terribly strong, hard-nosed guy. And yeah, I'm sure at times he said he was going to quit. He always said that he didn't come back to Madison to run a combined system. He came back to run the university, and he viewed the university as Madison. And because Joe Clatchy was here in Milwaukee, he accepted Milwaukee, but he wasn't terribly excited about Ed Widener in Green Bay or the chancellor at Parkside, mm-hmm. and whose name escapes me at the moment, who died, had a heart attack in the. I can still see his face, but his name escapes me. Anyway, John wasn't terribly fond of anything but running Madison and Milwaukee because he wanted the academic life, the collegial academic life, and not the administrative life that comes with running a big multi-system campus. And you know, he did all kinds of things to try to make that tolerable, including forming sort of an ad hoc council of multi-campus presidents that with guys like Boyer and from New York, and the guy from Texas and North Carolina, and all of that. And we had a lot of nice sessions with those people trying to share multi-campus experiences, but the frustration that they all had was that they didn't want the administrative stuff. Mm-hmm. When did that happen?
Yeah.
Oh, that went on early in merger.
Yes.
There were some, every 3, 4, 5 months those guys would get together, mm-hmm. someplace, either in Madison or in, I was at one session in Madison with them, but they lasted a couple of days. I went to New York for one session with John, and this was by this time I was when I was president of the board, I was more involved in that kind of stuff. But there was some informal give and take with other multi-campus people, but their universal frustration was that they all came up out of academia and they weren't academicians anymore.
Yeah, that frustration seems to have stuck. Mr. O'Neill quit, I think, for pretty close to the same reason.
Yeah, Bob O'Neill, I think, is a result of a poor board.
Yeah. How do you mean that?
Well, I think they just made a very, very bad choice. He's a great guy, but he's absolutely the wrong guy for that job. He had no business. A guy like Bob O'Neill has absolutely no business being in that kind of a position. He just could get chewed up and spit out, which is exactly what happened to him. And he got no help from his board. He got no support from that board at all. They were sniping at him behind his back all the time.
It seems to be a tough position to find a man for. The boards seem to want to appoint someone from academia, but at the same time.
Take your pick.
You're on the tape there.
Well, go on. I guess we could start again with the implementation committee. Lucy appointed Solberg, and who in turn appointed you? Was it Lucy appointed you to your position, or
no? I think Lucy structured the whole committee. To tell you the truth, I don't really remember. It may be that Lucy just appointed a chairman and let the board put people on it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember. But it became apparent early on that the principal thrust of that implementation committee was to draft some legislation. I mean, we actually had to draft a bill. We back on. It was apparent that the principal thrust of the committee was to come up with a piece of legislation. And you weren't going to be able to do that with the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had legislators on there, you had some students on there, you had some faculty on there, you had some regents on there, and it was apparent that you were not going to be able to draft legislation with this committee of 20. So Solberg and I and a couple of others discussed the possibility of a drafting subcommittee, creating a drafting subcommittee. And we did, and Jim did. And he appointed me the chair because it was easier for me to get to Madison. I mean, he didn't really want to take the time to do this. This was a damn time-consuming project. He didn't want to take the time to do it. He's a sole practitioner or a two-man office lawyer in Menominee. And time was money to him. I mean, I was part of a big firm, and time is money to me. But it's money spread out over 35 other partners, and my income isn't dependent solely on my own production, so I could afford the time. And I talked to my partners, and you know, they all knew I was involved, so they said, go ahead and do it. So I took the chairmanship of the drafting committee, and we just spent countless hours. Fortunately, I never kept track of drafting that bill and going over and over and over and over those provisions with a small subcommittee, a representative of the State University faculty and Clara Penniman from the UW faculty, as I recall, and a couple of the students. And it was and Dave Hansen, who's now one of my partners, who was sort of our counsel, and Bert Wagner, who's now out practicing law, and Madison, who was also on the staff of the university at that point, that sort of served as counsel. And we just spent a heck of a lot of time drafting legislation.
Mm-hmm. Did Lucy keep close watch on
your No, activity? I never talked to him during the whole time. I never talked to him during the whole time. That was also something that led me to believe he could care less.
Mm-hmm.
What came out of it. That really wasn't important to him.
Once the bill was passed,
he could care less.
What were the thorny issues then?
What were the thorny issues?
What were the? You said that there was no real we or factionalism on.
No,
that
there wasn't any particular we they. The issues were, how do you weave into the statute the fabric of faculty governance,
mm-hmm.
that was very, very strong within the old University of Wisconsin system and relatively unknown in the state university system. This was, you know, shortly after the great student rebellions. How do the students get their piece of the governance action? What are they primarily responsible for? And we ended up with you know, that primary responsibility clause of for the students that has gone to court a couple of times. The power of the legislature.
What was that clause again?
Oh, it was the student rights, and it's 36015, the duties and responsibilities of the various constituent groups within the university.
Mm-hmm.
And the students shall be primarily responsible for those matters directly affecting student life, mm-hmm. which is the
why
statute. Oh, because Baum and Werner Baum here in Milwaukee refused to appoint some students nominated by the students.
Mm-hmm.
And they got into that kind of hassle. And that language was important to the bill because it got the students on board. The bill was a series of, and I've described it before, and I see any reason to change, it was a series of delicate compromises. And it was a sort of a woven fabric, and if you cut one string, the whole thing would unravel on you. And we just had to make sure that we took care of all the constituent groups in one way or another, mm-hmm. including the legislators. George Molinaro and Walter Hollander were on that committee. George is dead, Walter's still around, representing the Assembly and the Senate. And they came to me early on and said, we're not going to watch you draft this bill. You go ahead and draft it the way you think it ought to be drafted. But I'll tell you what, there's one thing that we want in that bill. And that is that the legislature, and only the legislature, can close a campus. You put that restriction in, and you can have anything else you want. We don't care. And it's there. That provision is there. And that got them on board. And the students got on board with this language on their responsibilities that paralleled the language of responsibility of the faculty.
How did you go about chairing that committee? It was, the 22 on the bigger committee was too large, but it seems like everyone would want to have their 2 cents.
No, they really didn't. Yeah. See, it's much easier to carp after it's down on paper. It's a little difficult to sit around and say, well, now, okay, folks, we got to have a clause on faculty responsibility. Write it. That's too hard. That's very difficult. People didn't want to do that. People would rather have somebody else write it and then say, oh, Christ, that's wrong, and this is wrong, and we need this, and we need something on this and something on that. And that's how you get, that's how legislation is sometimes put together and comes out bad, because it's sort of hip-shooting thoughts that get tacked on here and there that end up being subject to lots of interpretation and really haven't been given much advanced thought. And that's what we tried to get around. And so we worked for 4, 5, 6 months, I think, putting that thing together. At times we were meeting every week. We'd meet an afternoon a week. I'd take at least one trip to Madison for that purpose every week.
Who did the most work on it?
I did.
Did you do a lot of the actual writing?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, but Muzak was involved and was around all the time, and Clara Penniman, yeah, Marshall Wick, great names out of the past. Jeez, I forgot him too. I'm trying to remember the student's name, the gal that was a student who's now working back at Madison. I ran into her a couple weeks ago at a party at UWM. She's working for the acting president now, that gal who was the vice president of academic affairs. I'm trying to remember her name. Mm-hmm. She was involved. She was very active in student government, and she was involved. A guy by the name of Brabin was involved from UWM. Bob Brabin, although he wasn't terribly effective at that point in time. I think he's gone on to get a law degree someplace. But everybody had a hand.
Joseph Nussbaum?
No, I don't recall Joe being terribly involved in that. My recollection of that, and as I say, I specifically did not go back to my files and try to resuscitate my then thoughts, mm-hmm. but my reaction to that, my reflection of that process was that everybody kind of participated, and nobody was a superstar. There wasn't anybody that dominated language, because they all had their own pet projects. The faculty were concerned about faculty governance language, and the students were concerned about student governance language, and the legislators were concerned about their perks, and the rest of it kind of flowed.
Well, Wick and Muzak were concerned, I'm sure, at that point and later on, with comparable funding and equitable salaries for the faculty in the system. Was that?
I don't recall that being a huge throwdown issue, mm-hmm. in the process. Sure, the merger was sold to a lot of these people on the idea that, at River Falls, we can have our salaries all raised to the Madison level if we're part of Madison. I mean, that was the selling point, and some of those people were stupid enough to believe that. And that argument was made all the time, but I don't think anybody ever accepted it. And the only people that really believed that it had any validity were the people that were making it, and I'm not sure some of them even believed it. I recall Irv Shane telling me one day about the about the disparity of the quality of education among the institutions that they, that they, a young man graduated from Oshkosh in chemistry, a chemistry major, with high honors, you know, 3.9 or 3.92, and wanted to go on for his master's and his PhD, and he wanted to come to Madison to do that, of course, because the program was so much better. He couldn't even get through the preliminary examination that they gave people as screening before they got into the program. Mm-hmm. I mean, his quantum of knowledge that he had learned at Oshkosh was so far below the quantum of knowledge for not only his peers, but people were, who were below him in grade point at Madison, that there was just no room for him in the program. I mean, it's relatively sad, because he went to Oshkosh believing that if he did well there, he could come on to Madison, and that's really the tragedy of it all. I mean, they sell those institutions as though you could come out of there and plug right in on a comparable level, and you can't do it.
Well, when you were finished with your work there, was that the bill that you had written, was it altered significantly by the legislature?
No, not a bit. The bill wasn't changed a whit in the legislature. There was some, the biggest debates were in the merger implementation committee, the implementation committee itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some, we had a couple of sessions on the bill as finally presented, and there was, you know, what I alluded to earlier, the carping type stuff of, hey, why didn't we have this, or we got to have this, or we got to have that sort of thing.
But after
but after the study committee, after the drafting committee was all done. But fortunately, the drafting committee held together solidly. I mean, we all recognized that this was a compromise. Mm-hmm. And we had the legislators on our side. I mean, I had George and Walter, who said, you know, this is a compromise, and these guys did it, and they spent all the time on it. And, you know, they know the trade-offs, and you can't take away one of the trade-offs without losing the other. So let's not mess around with this. And it went to the legislature in essentially the form that it came out of the drafting committee, and it came out of the legislature in exactly the form that it went in. And Lucy signed it without any problem.
When did you finish as a regent?
77.
Do you recall the problems with, were you working with the budget of the university at all after the merger in the first couple of?
Oh, sure. I was president of the board from 73 to 75. After the board was originally organized in 71, when the 72 annual meeting came around, Kopp got reelected, but Ziegler didn't want to run again for vice president. Mm-hmm. And so I was nominated and I won. So I was next in line, basically, as I was vice president from 72 to 73. Then I was president from 73 to 75. So sure, we were in the early throes of, you know, I was on the board's executive committee and all that sort of good stuff during all of that period.
Donald Smith claims that those first two budgets were a state of what he called crisis management for him and for the system because of Lucy's austerity.
The program? Sure. Yeah, there was a lot of that. You know, there was a, dear Mr. Pelosek, this is to inform you that the university will cut all programs 10% type stuff.
You said earlier when we first started that you had felt and still feel that there was efficiency to be gained from a merged system. Did you Did you see that happening then in 71 to 75?
Not particularly. No, I don't think that the optimistic expectations of merger were realized, because in implementation of those expectations, it becomes very difficult. I mean, it becomes a political process. I mean, one of the things that was done fairly early in the game was the creation of mission statements for all of the institutions, and some central administration came out with some suggested missions for the various institutions, and one of them was to eliminate graduate business programs at Whitewater. Mm-hmm. Now at Whitewater you had a legislator by the name of Byron Wackett, who had never voted for a university budget in 15 years. He'd been in the legislature for 15 years, at least. He was a strong, vocal opponent of the university. Never supported a university item in his whole career.
Are you speaking of Madison or?
No, I'm speaking of the mm-hmm. of the whole operation. He was not a great friend of higher education. Uh-huh. He was a very, very conservative guy from Walworth County, and he thought that the university was a hotbed of communists and radicals and all that good stuff. So sometimes one thinks it really is. And when it came time, when we went down to Whitewater for our mission statement hearing, we had hearings on all the campuses, we went down to Whitewater, the streets were lined with signs saying save our graduate programs. Mm-hmm. And Byron Wackett was up there leading the charge. I mean, he insisted on being the first speaker and making his emotional pitch to keeping these programs available at this fine institution. And a fine institution, he'd never supported the goddamn thing a day in his life. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, now that it was somehow being threatened, it was the most important thing in his whole political career. Well, I went on all over. Wackett's just happened to be more unusual than anybody else's, but they were all pushing the same thing, and that's why Hollander and Molinaro insisted that the legislature have the authority to close campuses. They're screaming and hollering about waste and duplication. I don't see any legislative initiative to close mm-hmm. Superior. It turned out to be an impossible task to really recognize and realize the efficiencies that could come from merger, because the system just resists that at every turn, including central administration. I mean, and all of the institutions, they all resist. And
I've heard it said that the merge board, there became sort of a one institution, one vote psychology, and that it became politically impossible for.
Well, I think that was a carryover from the mm-hmm. from the old WSU board. I think that for a number of years, I think well into my second term as president, you still had an us and them philosophy. And you still had State University people thinking totally in State University institutional context. And that just didn't disappear until 74, 75 in there, and it was diminishing, but it certainly was still there. I mean, it was very, very prevalent at the outset, and it diminished over time. In part, you had dilution; you had people going off, and being replaced by people who had never been regents before. In one instance, you had Arthur DeBartolet back, who was a strong advocate of of UW-Madison and viewed the other former WSU campuses with the same kind of disdain that was inherent in a lot of the Madison faculty and administration. But in many instances, you had people coming on, replacing people that had no background whatsoever, so they aren't going to have any particular loyalties to institutions or to systems the way that the other people did.
Did you see that thing occurring in the system administration as well? Sort of, Percy and Smith both make the claim that they overcame that.
I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true because they were so much better, frankly. I mean, they were really so much better than the average people that were in the WSU system administration. I mean, Smith is just a tremendous academic, vice president, just a tremendous guy at solving the conflicting ego problems that you get in academia. Percy was just a very smart, quick thinking guy. If Don had a shortcoming, it was that he wasn't sensitive enough to the academic necessities, the stroking and that sort of thing that was required. I think they did, because the UW people were the survivors. The old UW people were the survivors in the system, and some of the old WSU people that were visible, were up at the upper echelons, survived. Winter and what's the other guy's name? I can see his face too. Some of those guys that were in McPhee's office were okay. I mean, they were good guys. Winter in the physical facilities area wasn't terribly good. I'm trying to remember the other guy's name, who was basically on the academic side, who was a nice guy. Those guys hung around. In fact, I think Bob Winter is just retiring now, or just retired. But down below, the UW guys just totally predominated and just shoved the WSU people out of there, really. So I think, yes, that at the administrative level, to a great extent, that was overcome. And I think John worked hard at overcoming that at the top administrative level, too, with the chancellors. I mean, he worked hard at pulling the council up. He had his regular chancellors' meetings, and I think they worked very hard at getting them all to feel as though they were part of a single cohesive group. And John and Ed Young weren't terribly close either, so he wasn't bending over backwards to be nice to his buddy Ed Young, mm-hmm. who was then the chancellor at Madison. Joe Clatchy was something else. He was a good friend of Joe's, so. But that was a personal relationship, and Joe wasn't around there too long. Baum was in there fairly early on when Joe retired. But at the board level, there still was the we-them thing that went on for mm-hmm. some period of time.
Did you feel, I'm going to ask more about the budgets that Lucy had with respect to education, did you feel that Madison was suffering more than it would have been in an unmerged system because of that?
I couldn't speculate on that. That's a function of how good the university system operating by itself could have lobbied in that in a competitive atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And I've heard it said by people in the political arena that you could always run against the university, and that the university was a paper tiger. The university had a lot of growl, but they had tremendous potential for political influence exercising. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't handled very well. And
you're talking about before?
Well, at any time. I mean, this is what, this is people's observations about the university's political clout. Mm-hmm. Just, it ought to be strong, but it's kind of non-existent. They just don't manage it very well. They aren't reaching out to Green Bay and getting people of influence in Green Bay to say, hey, that place out there is important to us. Now, damn it, you, Mr. State Senator and Mr. Assemblyman, you vote to support that place on a reasonable basis.
Is that because, do you think, again, the question of what, of having someone from the academic world in the system presidencies rather than someone a little more politically...
No, I don't think that's necessary. I just think that's a very difficult job, and I don't think the university ever coped with it. I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that the university didn't use its potential to get back home. The university tried to concentrate its lobbying efforts on university people going from Bascom Hill or the backside of Bascom Hill where Van Hise is to the state capitol. And that was their lobbying effort, and they would put a lot into that, or they'd send us down there, and or that sort of thing. But they didn't really do what potentially they could do by reaching out into the state and getting people in the alumni clubs and that sort of thing, focusing on the budget problems and the university's problems.
I was just reminded of one issue that I forgotten earlier, is the location of the system administration. Was that?
Yeah, there was a little squabble about that. There was a squabble about what you were going to call the heads of the campuses, whether you're going to call them presidents or chancellors and that, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. There was some thought of moving the administrative office off the Madison campus and putting it off in state government someplace. Or mm-hmm. That didn't last too long. Although in other institutions it does that. At Missouri, it's off isolated in the corner of the... I mean, it's the system administration in Missouri is a relatively small system, but the system administration office is not in a building on the... It's on the campus, but it's off in its own little building.
Well, do you have any impressions now of how the merge system has performed? Has it saved the state money, and has it improved education?
Well, I think it's very hard to speculate on that, but I think that if you had not had it, you would continue to have had the log rolling efforts and the divisive efforts of two institutions fighting for a shrinking amount of dollars allocated to, or at least a shrinking proportion of the total state budget allocated to higher education. And I think that would have been damaging. I think what is disappointing is that the board has not come to grips with the real problem of implementing the efficiencies that are inherent, and potentially inherent at least, in the merged system. They just have not taken down some of these institutions. The most obvious example is the PhD in engineering. I mean, the PhD in nursing that was central administration. Both Madison and Milwaukee wanted them. Central administration recommended one. The damn board granted both of them. There's a serious question in my mind whether you needed one. And the board authorized two. And the board overrode central administration. Central recommended it be at Madison. Horton made such a big stink that it ended up getting them both. Now, if one was needed, it was probably needed here. Oh, I'm not really sure about that. I mean, I've listened to Horton, and Horton tells me that if there was one, it really ought to be here. Whether that's based on fact or whether that's based on his academic desire to have it here.
Here's UWM. Yeah,
right. And I don't, I can't evaluate that. But the point is that the Regents took the easy way out and overrode central administration and authorized both of them.
Any other
incredible
examples?
Incredible. Oh, there's a lot. I don't go to the. I haven't walked into the 18th floor of Van Hise Hall since my last meeting of the board in April or May of 1977. I've never been back. I don't even know if my picture still hangs on the wall. I asked Odie once in a while, and said it's the nail is bending. It's kind of sinking. But I haven't followed what's been going on. Specifically, I've just observed from the newspapers and from conversations with Horton and O'Neill and a few people that I see in the university hierarchy on a regular basis. I mean, Frank and Nancy Horton and my wife and I see each other socially a fair amount. And the Hortons are our social friends, and Frank is somewhat of a one-topic conversationalist. I mean, he wants to talk about the university all the time, and that's fine. And from listening to him, I've gathered a bit. I've talked to Bob and Karen O'Neill, our social friends also, but not as close because they're so far away. But I see other regents, Joyce Erdman, who was on the board with me for a while as a personal and business friend. So we see them, and I get bits and pieces of what's going on at the system. But I think it is quite clear that with a shrinking dollar, a shrinking dollar availability, with less funding available, that if you are going to maintain quality, you have to do something about duplicative programs and eliminate some programs. And if kids have to wait an extra year to get out, that's too bad. I mean, I feel sorry for that, but you know, you can only do what the state can basically afford to do. I'm not so sure, that's not a comment that's limited to the university. I mean, all of state government seems to be very, very difficult, and even the federal government seems to be very difficult in making the tough decisions that have to be made.
Is this a problem that you attribute to, I mean, the personnel on the board, or is it?
I think the personnel on the board is quite mediocre at the moment.
I mean, this example you give of the nursing PhD program and the present problem with faculty salaries, you know, in Madison versus in the old WSU campuses, the board seems to be, I mean, one of your advantages you cited of the system, of the merged system, was that this log rolling would stop. And it doesn't seem to be stopping these people from Eau Claire bypassing the board and going directly into the legislature and stumping for their 9% increase. Is that's not an institutional problem? That's people on the board should be doing their job?
Yeah, I think I think the board is relatively weak, and the people are relatively ineffective. Mm-hmm. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any real cohesiveness on the board. I think you just have some very ineffective and ineffectual people on that board at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Could it be that the board is not attracting the quality people that it once did?
Oh no, I don't think that's the case. Mm-hmm. I think that's inherent in the. In the selection process that has been forthcoming from the last several governors, mm-hmm. and that's not a political bias, because I think it's as true of the Dreyfus mm-hmm. operation. I mean, I think Sherm put some real nerds on there, and I think mm-hmm. Anthony J. Earle has certainly followed with some real weak people. You got to, you know, a governor has that problem. He doesn't know how people are going to react sometimes. But you ought to know a little bit better than, and I think he at least this governor has. But he's more interested in in special interest group balance. I mean, he's got to placate all kinds of special interest groups, and in doing that, you end up with pretty weak stuff.
So you think that it is, that it's politically possible to, say, close a campus in the northeast part of the state, or?
Yeah, I think if the board took a position, I mean, if the board finally said, look, we just can't afford Superior. I mean, it's now down to a couple thousand students. I don't know what the student population is at Superior, but it wasn't very much 8 years ago. I can't imagine it's substantially gone up, especially when you have a University of Minnesota campus right across the way and you can share, you have reciprocity. The board said, Superior's got to go. We will close Superior. I think they'd probably get legislative support. I think the public perception would be that that is a huge saving of money. I'm not so sure that it is, but the public perception is that it would be a huge saving of money, and the public pressure would be so strong to support that that the local guy couldn't save it.
Well, in my interview with Fish, he was talking about the recent faculty pay package, and that they did a peer group study, you know, how they do to determine what the increases would be. He said that the Madison campus should get 15% and these other people should get 6. And he said that it was politically impossible to recommend 6. They had to go to at least 9% for them.
I don't dispute that.
Yeah. But it seems that these people associated with these other campuses do have enough power to...
Oh, I think that's just logic.
Yeah.
I mean, if you walked in here and asked the 80 lawyers that sit in here whether there ought to be a disparity of 9% in salary increases, that Madison ought to get 15 and Oshkosh ought to get 6, they're going to look at you and say, hey, that's not fair. They're not going to know a damn thing about it, but that just doesn't strike one as fair. I mean, if Oshkosh is so bad, fire the guy, or close the place down is a natural reaction, I think. I don't think that the two of them are related at all. I think you'd have enough political clout to close a campus. I just don't think the central administration or the regents have the guts at the moment. I'm not so sure I would either. You know, we tried to close a lousy center at Medford and couldn't get it done, or a center at Richland Center. I mean, I got more mail on that than any other matter. That was even more important in the eyes of those people than unlimited visitation and co-ed housing, which were the other great issues of our time in the late 60s and early 70s. We used to get bushel baskets of mail in here from Richland Center, and they were all the same. Somebody mimeographed a letter and sent it off to distribute it all over town, said, send this to this list of names, so write it out in longhand. And they wrote it out in longhand, and hundreds of pieces of mail had come in here. Save our center. You can't close down our little center. Legislators react. It's a groundswell when they get 3 pieces of correspondence.
There's great fear from the people on the Madison campus that since the merger, the flagship campus has been sinking slowly, that the money that should be going there has been drifting away from it, and that higher education in Wisconsin is suffering as a result. Faculty are leaving and are going to be leaving more and more rapidly because we're not paying them. We're paying people in Eau Claire. Do you see that as a problem that's related to a merge system? Or
I don't think that's related to a merge system at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if Madison was really concerned about the sinking ship, they would do a hell of a lot more internal evaluation and decide what wasn't necessary and what they could eliminate and reallocate those monies. And I think they could make a justifiable case for that, but they don't.
Why not?
I don't think the guy in the history department wants to say, well, we really ought to cut out Slavic languages, because he's afraid once you start that process, next week they may decide that they want to keep Slavic languages and cut out history. Mm-hmm. Once you establish the principle, mm-hmm. then you have to worry about how the principle is going to be applied. And it might well be applied to you. And therefore, it's much more in your interest not to apply the principle. Academia has always seemed to me to be a bastion of self-preservationists. Mm-hmm. I don't think anything's changed in higher education since I got in or since I got out in that regard.
Well, I think I've covered all the bases that I want to.
Okay, good. It was a pleasure. Now I have to decide when I can release this. Huh?